Welcome, everyone, to Reimagining Cyber. Rob here with Stan, and today's special guest, we're going to have an old friend of mine, Stan, who I met several years ago in my backyard here in Boston. He was the former CISO of State Street. Previous to that, he was with London Stock Exchange, and now he's running the global cyber practice for resiliency at Kyndryl. So I'm really looking forward to the conversation with him today.
Yeah, it's great to have him on. Today's guest, Rob, is Adil Saeed. Hey, we're thrilled to have you on our podcast, Adil, and it's great to have you finally on. Before we dive into the conversation, would you mind delving a bit more into your background and share with our listeners some of your impressive career journey?
Stan, thank you. You're too kind, you and Rob. So I appreciate you having me on the podcast. It's a privilege to be here. Quick background, I know you touched on a few organizations, but primarily on the infrastructure information security side across the organizations that you mentioned, also including State Street Bank and Trust as their CISO. So, you know, as we've all said, security is not by design, it's by accident. And our job is to prevent accidents from happening. So is baptism by fire or by trial and error? So looking forward to this conversation.
That is so true. Well, one area that's sort of baptism by fire, I think, is just the fact that, you know, there's so much data being collected by organization, and how you govern that data and secure it is one of the big challenges we're faced today. And that's one of the areas we want to focus on. And as organizations are trying to both monetize their data as well as, you know, improve their decision-making process, leveraging that data, we also can't forget about the security and privacy aspects of that. And so can you, you know, share what you think some of these organizations are doing as far as placing an importance on that aspect of the data collection challenge?
I think it's a never-ending deal, right? Because everything revolves around data and how you're protecting that data, whether you, I mean, it'll be a miss for us not to mention AI in the conversation.
That's true.
Right? It's all based on data. And as regulators across the globe are catching up or are sometimes ahead of the curve in certain regulations, right? Or at least trying to manage, not to curb the innovation, but to manage the proliferation and the avoidance of how security becomes an ultimate issue. And it protects the ultimate consumer. In this case, could be a business or a B2C person. At the end of the day, it's all our data, right? And how do we protect it? And that data security element has not changed so far. We've historically focused on securing the data through access management or through some sort of encryption or through excessive monitoring or logging. But to follow the lineage of that data or to be able to monitor it, manage it, and continuously validate whether the access is provided day one or still relevant day two, is, I think, a homework question for all of us. And I think industries are still, or at least many organizations, I think, if not all, are not struggling with it, but they're trying to come to terms with how regulation meets the rubber of, you know, the regulatory road, as an example, so to speak. And I think we are all on that journey together. It hasn't been solved yet, but I think this is a very interesting area for us all to double click on. And I think this is one area, if I were to say, it's not going to be done by a solution or an organization. I think it's more of an open source forum where we all have to get our heads together to find the right streamlined view of how we protect it.
Yeah, it's definitely more of a true ecosystem, if you will, approach.
Yeah.
Right. And so speaking of regulations, I mean, Stan and I have had conversations on many topics relative to regulatory requirements. You know, we've spanned the discussions as it relates to all of the different privacy regulations, the many that we have here in the US is an example of that, of course, internationally as well. The new SEC cyber rule that went into effect at the end of 2023. You know, but one deal we haven't really discussed is DORA, right? The Digital Operation Resiliency Act. And it's coming out of the EU, right? Now that's going to go into effect January of 2025. But, you know, the way I'm reading and interpreting, I want to get your thoughts on this, is that it's yet another lever that really, again, regulators are trying to leverage as taking kind of aim at the leadership and the boards of organizations to help better drive cybersecurity principles, capabilities, and prove that you're really doing these things back at them very directly. So I wanted to get your thoughts kind of at a high level on your interpretation of DORA and some of the things that you see coming out of it and opportunities it can present.
Absolutely. Well, that's DORA is an interesting paradigm. I think we have all been flirting around with third-party risk management for a while. based on different industries that we have been in, whether it's regulatory, non-regulatory, and there hasn't been a global impetus, to say the least, on how are you managing risk from the dependency that you have in your wider ecosystem, be it vendors, suppliers, or critical service providers. And I think what DORA is trying to accomplish is exactly that, right? How are you managing the overall risk posture of your environment on the key dependency that you have, and not just a logistics-based risk or financial risk, which many companies used to do from a TPRM perspective. It's more a continuous risk of how you have the ability first to map your ecosystem in a diligent manner, identify those exact critical service providers or providers in your ecosystem, and being able to manage it. So I think it's exciting times. And regulatory, you know, impetus and exciting times might be an oxymoron or might be opposites. But I think in this particular instance, Robin Stan, I think what we are seeing is there's a lot of work happening in the background where many organizations, in performing a variety of assessments that they normally perform, right? Compliance assessments or third-party risk assessments, or even SOC compliance as an example, is all coming together at least one framework. So credit to DORA, right? First, to at least set the guardrails, because before it was subject to interpretation. What's good, what's not. Now at least you have a set of guidelines, right, to follow, or which are going to evolve over time, right, as we live and learn, no different to GDPR. But at least it sets the standard on what an organization needs to do to safeguard them. No different to what you mentioned on the SEC side, right? The reporting piece. It's crystal clear in what time frame you have to report a particular incident and the guardrails of those incidents. I think DORA is leading towards that almost with another angle coming back in. So this gives two, if you may, this gives two supporting elements to any security professional within any organization. It gives them the opportunity to get what they actually want in order to get that framework done, right? Which is always a challenge. Budget, resources, and also with this will come with a lot of tools and services which companies can provide on top of that when these CISOs or CIOs will get that required funding in order for them to be able to get compliant with this regulation.
And again, it's nice to have that clarity because the business can then act because you didn't know what you need to do. One other area, another issue that is coming up frequently is this whole issue of data sovereignty, right? And some of the challenges around it. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with the concept of data sovereignty, it refers to the idea of a country or a jurisdiction that has authority and the rights to govern and control the data generated within its borders, right? And so, you know, could you share some of the best practices that organizations should adopt when, you know, they're addressing, you know, their desire to roll out a service or, you know, have infrastructure in different jurisdictions and at the same time be cognizant of data sovereignty impact?
Well, Stan, it's not new, but it is new, right? To say the least, data sovereignty as we are evolving. And I think some of us, including myself, have confused that data sovereignty piece with data privacy and data residency, or at least taken both of them in different contexts, again, subject to interpretation. But what data sovereignty is driving is almost like, and I'm going to use cloud as a good example of this, right? A sovereign cloud infrastructure set, which is hosted in a particular jurisdiction or geography, and only the constituents of that geography that might be related to that by birth, by nationality, or by wisdom, or by allocation have access to that, right? And then at that stage, do those individuals or services have access to it outside of that jurisdiction is still subject to interpretation, right? That's where the privacy kind of comes into play is, can I access my sovereign cloud, which might be in country X, if I'm in country Y? Those are still subject to interpretation to different countries. So just double clicking on that. Infrastructure locally hosted in a data center that's only accessible to those in a data center. I think we've all been through that a little bit. Now it's being evolved to call data sovereignty. Sovereign clouds are coming up in different countries. I think we're seeing proliferation of that. And to say the least, that's because everyone is trying to avoid who has the right to access the data in an eventuality if something happens, something good or something bad happens. What's the reach around? How far can you reach into someone's data privacy? As an example, if you use California's, you know, CCPA law, if your data is stored anywhere and there's a California constituent in there, you have to comply with it. Otherwise, you will have a potential you know, fine associated with it if you have not cleared that data. So using Sovereign Cloud as an example, I think one of the things that, at least based on my experience and based on what you're seeing, or at least speaking with some of my peers, is you need to be able to understand not just setting up an infrastructure which caters to that jurisdiction, but also the right level of technologies and control, be it tokenization, be it encryption, or be it the amount, like, it's not that it's one and done. How do you control the data movement, which is in none of our controls, unless you're managing security at a data level, not just at a network or an infrastructure level? So the origination of that, the retention of that, and then the dissemination of that and the demolition, the entire cradle to grave lifecycle of data, I think, is a key element in data sovereignty. And no one solution fits it.
You have to think that through, right, up front in the design, because you don't want to do it after the fact, after you've deployed and implemented, because then you may have, you know, to rethink how you actually built your infrastructure and deployed it, much less that top layer that you were talking about as far as the access governance to the data. Anyway, I think it's a complicated problem.
And I totally agree with you, and you can see a little bit of passion in this. It's because you're absolutely right. It you have to do it from the ground up, but the ground reality is not many sovereign, you know, data sovereignty requests are not on anything new. They have to cover legacy as well, right? And I think that's our collective challenge as an industry to kind of solve for. So that's a good, interesting conversation for some time.
That kind of leads us into what I'd like to talk to you about next. But before I do that, I think you just made something very clear for the audience, that distinction between data sovereignty and data residency. They are two different things. And I think that the way you explained it was very clear to really distinguish the two. But getting into that next kind of set of conversation that takes us into data and data as it serves potentially as technical debt. And the reality is heavy costs and a lot of risk comes along with that. And to your point, many organizations hold on to data a lot longer than they should. There's requirements in place, you know, with HIPAA, for example, that you should hold on to it for a specific time. You're required to do so. That's fine. Many organizations, larger organizations that do a lot of M&A activity, they inherit these systems, applications, along with the data sets supporting them. And they don't necessarily go back and assess, you know, where are there areas that we actually can minimize some of those data sets that are out there? Because again, all they're doing is adding costs and additional risk, right? God forbid those systems are breached, and we should have never even had that data still held in place out there available for someone to get to. So I kind of look at that again as, you know, avenues of opportunity of where we can actually apply really that lifecycle approach. Because as you said, it's easy when it's at inception of a new project, a new solution that we're bringing to market. Mm-hmm. Let's be at the front end. Let's be aware of what's happening. And now it's truly that lifecycle. But there is so much legacy, you know, inserting ourselves kind of somewhere in the process has to take us back to discovering and understanding what we actually already have, being able to apply classification to that. You earlier mentioned, you know, the data lineage. I mean, the so many different elements that come into play when we talk about data. What I want to kind of delve into, Adil, is when you look at that as a kind of framework as it relates to how do we approach this in reducing that technical debt? What do you think about? What are some of the requirements or kind of recommendations that you drive at in discussions?
You know, what comes to my mind is you can never get rid of data. It's that it's just there with you for life. But Rob, to answer your question, and by the way, thank you for that summary. That was very eloquent. It kind of helps drive a lot of clarity. I think, you know, technical debt or data debt has a lifeline associated with it. What's untested so far is the regulatory reach of that data. What happens if you do something with it, right? Everything has a lifeline. But with the new regulations coming out in some cases, you used healthcare data as an example, right? Some jurisdictions have certain, you know, expiration dates associated with it. But that does not get rid of the metadata that already exists in your system, right? You're not getting rid of that. So I believe if you go on to a modernization approach, and that word has been used loosely and heavily across the industries, various industries, you know, we've been hearing about that for the last 10 years. But if you really look at modernization, it is converting that legacy infrastructure or legacy debt to a more modern infrastructure. And organizations that are banking on that modernization effort, I think it's a prime opportunity for them to start from ground zero. Ground zero in the sense is, point in time, I mean, historically, if you remember Rob and Stan, we used to do like, you know, you're putting a new backup solution in place. You're like, well, at this date, all this data will be available through 6 means of access, and everything new will be here. So you had 2 screens. Over time, companies stopped doing that due to the inefficiency. I think some of those old habits have to come back, right? Which is, this is sitting over here. It's archived, but it's not going to be archived anymore. Right? So you fit that criteria. And I think because storage became cheaper, cloud has proliferated, everyone has access to unlimited storage instead of a USB drive anymore. I think that is driven. So simple answer over there, Rob, might not be fun, but we have to go back to the basics, right? Which is point in time, cut it off and move on. Because I have yet to see anything that kind of helps solve that problem. But it's another interesting problem for us to socialize and discuss if there is an opportunity for it to be reviewed from a technical standpoint.
You know, this technical debt is also a potential entry point for attackers, yep. Right? And, you know, if you aren't actively using these older systems, or you may have legacy data architectures, you may have incompatible data formats or inefficient data processing practices that, again, may not be a point of focus for the organization, doesn't really matter to the bad actors, right? They can take advantage of that. Even if you're not focused on that at the moment, they can still, in the environment, take advantage of those legacy aspects of this, of your environment, to be able to exploit and potentially even, you know, launch ransomware attacks. Awesome. So I guess in that context of this multifaceted kind of problem, how do you, you know, safeguard your data effectively? And again, you know, one of the biggest pain points organizations face today is the threat of ransomware. And in the context of having a mature data strategy, including backups and archiving that hopefully are immune to ransomware bears that are typically trying to subvert your controls, what do you recommend as a strategy?
KYC is a term that's used a lot, right? Knowing your customer from a compliance perspective. I think we've all come to terms over the last 10 years based on the geopolitical influence in the world. And that's just because to know who is who and are you really who you are, which kind of leads to zero trust, which has been used loosely, which is a framework, started off as a framework, became a solution, but it's still a framework that many companies struggle with because it's so massive that they're like, where do we start? I think, Stan, to answer your question, KYC to zero trust, I call it KYD, know your data. One of the key elements is know where your data is. That mapping exercise of identifying your data and then safeguarding it using zero trust principles, right, needs to KYC, knowing where your customer is. So if you go reverse in that order, until you know that, it's very hard for you to understand what it is. And I think having a committed set of resources to perform that task, which might sound menial, can actually pay dividends, because that is the crux of anything that any organization is trying to do, protect your data. All right. And kind of leads that. So that would be the short form answer for that. And I think we should do that.
It brings up a very key point, Adil, which is I've seen too many a time where organizations have taken kind of the priority being around how they protect the data from more of a encryption, data masking, tokenization kind of principle, if you will. And they take that as the priority. They want to do that first. And I question them. But do you even know what data you have to actually properly protect? And the answer is kind of, I think I know the things that I need to protect, but yeah, I probably don't know all of that. So it's like, where should you really be investing first, right? So again, that goes back to what you're talking about. It's like, you need to have visibility, understanding of what actual data you have, how to categorize it or classify it, align it to the business, what the business is stating is important to them, that is sensitive information. And now you can apply the right protection schemes supporting the need of that classification, if you will, for that data. And again, that goes back to your earlier core discussion point around this is a life cycle approach. Yes. So it's continuous. You're always going through that. Now, one of the things that, as we were talking about the topic of data today, that ties back into kind of the foundation of why Stan and I actually created this podcast about 3 years ago, is the topic of cyber resilience. Mm-hmm. And so obviously cyber resiliency is a core theme that we've been pushing very heavily. You are a major proponent of cyber resilience, which we appreciate. And I would love to have your kind of perspective of, you know, guidance to the audience of the principles and the best approaches to help kind of start shaping and reshaping, in many cases, the cybersecurity kind of posture transition to a more of a cyber resilient approach.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Rob. And I think it's a great opportunity, as I mentioned in the beginning, to sit with you and Stan to kind of help share and learn from our colleagues in the wider spectrum. One thing that I've learned the hard way, resiliency is not recovery, right? And resiliency is not just backup. Business continuity is a core element, but that's not cyber resiliency. To be resilient is to understand your weak points, where your weaknesses are, and which are the areas you need to focus on. So food for thought, and apologies if I'm being repetitive, is to understand your environment, number one. Risk manage it, risk rate it, which application, systems, services need to be there in order for the business to operate. That's the first and fundamental rule of thumb. Don't go after, you know, email as a core. Just say we're going to have two email systems. One is going to be here. This is totally resilient. That's a great way of starting, but at least understanding your inventory of where you are, risk rated. No different to BCP principles. But adding on top of that is to understand your resiliency posture, is what your threat vectors are, attack vectors are, and how you can actually protect them in order to safeguard the data. Understand the attack vector means you should be able to know that this data could be subject to malware or ransomware, which totally throws your resiliency posture out the way, because you might have done a test, but that synchronous replication, which is in a second, might actually not cause you to do that. So know your RTOs, right? Know your RPOs at a point in time. Make sure you design your infrastructure, not end-to-end, but at least your core systems to be resilient enough to have this air gapping technology or validation technology. Goes back to the know your data example, because you can bring up a system, but if your data is all gone, there's absolutely no reason to bring that system up. And then don't go with traditional measures, you know, of having, you know, a primary, secondary. It works. It's great. It's great from a backup perspective, but it's not necessarily resilient. Defense in depth, which we have used in the security world for so long, sometimes, you know, does not get the respect that it needs. It actually does work, right? In having different solutions being your primary and your secondary to add to that resiliency, because resiliency is not just in an application and data. Resiliency is also on the infrastructure, right? Or the network, or the services that you depend on. So spot on, cyber resiliency, core to all of us, you know, and the most, and last but not least, without sounding like a broken record, is you can have all the solution, but without effective testing and effective validation is as good as not having it at all. But updating that, and not the old school way of, you know, keeping an Excel spreadsheet validation of that. That's great. The systematic approach, the right solutions, whether it's technical, services or infrastructure base, should be in place and kept up to date to manage your resiliency posture. And having that done twice a year, or if not more, is the way to go.
Adil, would you add to that? It's a great definition of what needs to be done, but how you evolve or adapt to the threat. I mean, granted, you're understanding the attack vectors, but those can change over time. And so you also are needing to continuously monitor what's new, right?
Well, absolutely, Stan. And thank you for that. I think the evolution, or let's look at zero-day threats, right? And I think one of the things that we should focus on, which again, sometimes you can solve for it, is how do we avoid that zero-day threat? Let's say if an organization gets impacted by that, but there is no remedy for it, right? And you have planned your resiliency around your infrastructure, your system to be able to recover, is what other options do you have? Can you fail over to another solution, which is always being there, right? Old school days, you know, hot and cold backups, right? You have a hot side and you have a cold side. Cold side is as, and I think it's coming back, right? That cold side concept of this is my most pristine data that's there. I might not have real-time information, right? But I will be able to have a resiliency posture where I can bring the data set up, or I can bring my application up back the next day. Now, some might say it's radical, but that might be another course of action to take in this case, because escaping a zero-day attack is something that we all fear about. And unless you have invested heavily, heavily, heavily in segregating that, you still have that insider risk. You still have that insider proliferation. So the vectors are so vast, Stan, that it's almost like, let's get the basics right. Right. And where there is room for improvement, let's try to go the extra mile to kind of set, as you mentioned, you know, look for that vector, which you can't really conquer at this stage.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah. And just to kind of close out on the cyber resiliency piece there too. At the end of the day, it's, as you kind of tied back into, it's minimizing the impact as best possible. Right. But the The aspect of cyber resilience to me, and over the past few years, I think has finally received the buy-in that we focus in from the technology side of the house, from the executives and board level, specifically because they understand resilience. They understand operational resilience. So now we're actually speaking in their language, right?
Absolutely.
And it's understood. And we boil it down to the kind of four key goals of resiliency as it relates to the cyber requirements. And they get it. They interpret it like, yeah, that's my business operational resiliency model. It's applied to cyber. Now it makes sense, right? So I think it's made a lot of great progression, and it's finally starting to open up the way we should be conversing properly with the board and the buy-in that it deserves. So Adil, we greatly appreciate your time coming on. We know we can talk with you about not only this topic, many topics for many hours, but we decided to focus in on the topic of data, and you did a great job in helping paint the picture for everyone listening here, what you're thinking about, what you're seeing out there. So we appreciate that. Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Adil.
Hello, producer Ben here, and as you can imagine, that's not the first conversation that Stan and Rob have had about data here on Reimagining Cyber. I advise you to take a listen to episode 43. It's called Inside the Fight, Protect Data from Quantum Computers, and features Terence Spies, the CTO of CyberRes Voltage, and a veteran cryptographic engineer.
The silver lining to this cloud is that the folks at NIST, National Institute for Standards and Technology, have spent the last 6 years working with cryptographers basically around the planet on sort of bring the Justice League together, superheroes assemble kind of job to say, hey, how do we find algorithms that are not vulnerable to these kinds of attacks?
That was Terence Spies, the CTO of CyberRes Voltage, on episode 43, Inside the Fight to Protect Data from Quantum Computers. Please feel free to share Reimagining Cyber with a friend or perhaps a colleague. Even better, someone who is both a friend and a colleague. Thanks for listening and goodbye.